Welcome to the Town Hall Review, brought to you by the Salem Media Group. I'm Hugh Hewitt. California is burning, with fires taking a brutal human toll. For much of their century-long lives, Sarah and Charles Rippey lived together. On Sunday night, the couple of 75 years died together in their house in Napa. This one has hit a beautiful place, California's Napa Valley, with impacts well beyond the Golden State.
We're the fifth largest economy in the world, and a lot of that is burning.
Another sex scandal has surfaced. This one comes from the top ranks of the rich and famous, where it was covered up for a long time.
And you look at the list of movies and of plays and of TV shows that he has been involved with. It is just extraordinary. Does that excuse him from common human decency?
Plus, President Trump's comment on modernization for nuclear arsenal draws media scrutiny.
I want to have absolutely perfectly maintained nuclear force.
Thank you for joining us. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. You can hear my own program live each weekday morning, 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. Eastern, and online via my site, HughHewitt.com, and on your handheld device via TuneIn Radio app. California's autumn can be cruel. Instead of leaves turning, wildfires are once again burning. October fires pushed by dry northeast winds are often the worst. Ironically, the drought-busting rains in Northern California last winter grew a huge crop of foliage, which in late summer became an abundance of dry brush. In the past, the fires have hit lush, wealthy areas like Beverly Hills, Laguna Beach, Malibu. This time, they chose beautiful Napa Valley. At midweek, it looked like this. I read from this morning's San Francisco Chronicle, at least 17 people have been killed and 3,000 buildings burnt to the ground after fires erupted on Sunday, tearing through northern Santa Rosa, the wine country, and elsewhere in the north state. The ravaged areas are still very vulnerable. Even though we've had five disasters in 6 weeks, arguably each one worse than the one before it. Las Vegas trauma of last week, 58 dead and 450 wounded. That's pretty awful, but they've got 240 people missing in Sonoma County. Now, some of those people will show up, and some will never show up. One of the most heartbreaking stories of all by Herman Wong in the Washington Post. For much of their century-long lives, Sarah and Charles Rippey lived together. On Sunday night, the couple of 75 years died together in their house in Napa. When a wind-whipped wildfire engulfed their home, caused the roof to cave in, the windows to explode, trapping them inside, their son Chuck told NBC Bay Area. Sarah was 98. Charles was 100. They met almost 90 years ago as grade schoolers in Hartford, Wisconsin, the New York Times reported. They married in 1942, celebrated their 75th wedding anniversary with all five of their children in March. The only thing worse would have been if one survived without the other, their granddaughter Ruby Gibney told KTVU. The Rippies were the first confirmed fire fatalities in Napa County, and among at least 17 people have perished in the wildfires ravaging Northern California. The inferno on Sunday night simply moved too quickly for the couple to escape. Their caregiver tried to rescue the couple who had been sleeping, managed to get Sarah into a wheelchair, but ultimately ran out of time, the couple's son, Mike, told the New York Times. Their caregiver called me and said there was fire everywhere. I said, just get those guys out on the street. Before she knew it, the roof was caving in. It was so very fast, very fast. She went down to get my father, and all the windows started to explode, and all there was smoke and heat and all everywhere. She just couldn't find them. She was barely able to get out of time, wasn't able to get to them, Napa County Sheriff Sergeant Mark Foster said. Charles, however, managed to fight through the house, the intense smoke and heat, and almost made it to his wheelchair-bound wife's side. They found their remains together on Monday. Charles, known as Peach, on Tuesday, Chuck and his brother Mike searched through the charred remnants of their parents' house, which they'd called home for 35 years. Not much other remained, other than faint signs of where a front door had been, charred heap of what used to be the garage and an old Lexus, Mike told the New York Times. That same morning, President Trump was tweeting profusely. Maybe he was exhausted by the rash of disasters, 5 in 6 weeks. On my program, I turned to Politico's Jake Sherman to discuss this tweet barrage. We'll begin with my recap of the president's latest on Twitter. 9 hours ago, he tweeted, "The fake news is at it again, this time trying to hurt one of the finest people I know, General John Kelly, by saying he will soon be fired. That story is totally made up by the dishonest media. The chief is doing a fantastic job for me and, more importantly, for the USA." And then 13 minutes ago, and then 7 and 3 minutes ago, stock market has increased by $5.2 trillion since the election on November 8th, a 25% increase. Lowest unemployment in 16 years, and if Congress gives us the massive tax cuts and reform I'm asking for, those numbers will grow by leaps and bounds. It would be really nice if fake news media would report the virtually unprecedented stock market growth since the election, period, need tax cuts. Jake, what do you make of the president's tweets this morning?
He's been talking about this for some time, right? He wants people to talk about the stock market. I understand that. The stock market is on its way up. But listen, the Washington Post just popped a very consequential, I think, story that has Tom Barrack, who's a very close friend of Trump and the chairman of his inauguration, saying that he doesn't really know what's happened to the president. He doesn't agree with how he's behaving. It's one of the more stunning admissions from a Trump insider that we've seen. And I think, listen, it's obvious. I'm not saying anything that anybody else won't say or doesn't say. If Trump didn't challenge his Secretary of State to an IQ contest and do all this other stuff, people might be talking about the stock market and the chance for what he considers to be transformational tax reform. So, you know, it's the same story we've heard from January, I think.
You know, he won a round with the NFL yesterday, but he's losing a round by, I think, personally, not looking at what is happening on the two sides of America, the Puerto Rico disaster and this massive disaster, Jake, in California. In fact, I don't think D.C. quite gets California yet. Do you think you have a good grip on how savage is the destruction out there? Because I do. My friends have been telling me.
Trump has really caught a very difficult break on a lot of these disasters in Puerto Rico, Florida, Texas, California. And it's crass a little bit to focus on the political, but there is a political element of this. And it's a very tricky situation to be a president in these overseeing disaster relief and things of that nature, because so much could go wrong and you get blamed for it either way, even if you don't really deserve the blame.
And on top of all of that, there is a very steadily advancing regulatory rollback. The Supreme Court dismissed the case against one of two cases against the executive order on immigration travel yesterday. They're not even going to hold hearings on it. And Scott Pruitt successfully unveiling the rule to repeal the Clean Power Plan, following the rule to modify the waters of the U.S. There is a lot of change going on, but people, the kind of stories you would normally cover, you're not, because there are meteors striking the media landscape. Maybe we're wrong. He beat the NFL at their own game, right? They folded. The commissioner threw in the cards, though. It was dross. He couldn't just say stand up or get out, which is what the long memo boils down to. He clothed it in a bunch of dross. As if this rash of floods, hurricanes, massacres, and fires was not enough to occupy the media, a famously successful film producer, Harvey Weinstein, was finally outed on charges of sexual harassment, indeed of rape, and the accusers have started to multiply. Within the industry, Weinstein's excesses were not really new at all. My colleague and film critic, Michael Medved, explains.
Now, there's always been controversy regarding film and the film community, but I can't remember a more disgraceful, disturbing story than all of this continued expose about Harvey Weinstein. I mean, you cannot pick up any major publication. There's a huge and thoroughly disgusting article in the New Yorker magazine. It's written by Rowan Farrow, who you may remember, he comes from his own very problematic background. He's supposed to be the son of Mia Farrow and Woody Allen. But Mia Farrow says he's actually the son of Mia Farrow and Frank Sinatra. Who knows? In any event, he has written this long New Yorker piece that describes in truly revolting detail some of the excesses of Harvey Weinstein: assaulting, raping, molesting, attacking young women who were dependent on him or working for him in many cases, going all the way back to the 1990s. There's also another New York Times article, and it's just a mind blower. So finally, after a week of silence, there is a formal statement from Hillary Clinton. I can read it to you. It's very brief. "I was shocked and appalled by the revelations about Harvey Weinstein. The behavior described by women coming forward cannot be tolerated. Their courage and the support of others is critical in helping to stop this kind of behavior." Okay. CNN, yes, CNN, right, otherwise known as the Clinton News Network, is just reaming Hillary, just ripping Hillary, because there's nothing more than this rather bland statement, and it's very, very late. It's problematic for several reasons. Number one, because Harvey Weinstein was such a prominent supporter of hers. He raised hundreds of thousands of dollars for her various campaigns. He was a good friend of the Clintons. And they're not going to comment on it. Well, look, this is about as serious as a heart attack for Secretary Clinton, because she has a husband who has also been accused of sexual harassment. And as a matter of fact, it's kind of acknowledged it. What do you call it when you get involved with, she was 22 at the time, an intern in the White House, and other allegations of unwanted attacks by the governor, the attorney general of Arkansas, and then later the president. Look, I don't know where this thing goes. I don't know where it I know it doesn't stop here, because it's just getting started. We are going to have a tidal wave of exposés and attacks. It's hard for me to understand how this is good for the country. I mean, you can say it's good for the country, good for the universe, good for planet Earth, that Harvey Weinstein is no longer in a position of power. But he's not the only one. Not the only one in Hollywood. He's not the only one in government. He's not the only one in politics. He's not the only one in corporate America. He's not the only one in religious life. I mean, if we are going to now go through a series of these attacks of empowered men who prey on unsuspecting women, this is going to become another new national obsession. If you go back and you look at the list of movies and of plays and of TV shows that he has been involved with, it is just extraordinary. This is somebody with a very, very big record in the movie business. Does that excuse him from common human decency? You think not? Of course not.
Coming up,
I am all for the president being all in on modernization, which is desperately needed in our nuclear force. Since 1945, our nuclear deterrent has been the U.S. strategic advantage over our adversaries. The argument that we haven't used them so they're irrelevant is completely dumb, for lack of a better word.
Nuclear buildup or simply modernization? The Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. If you miss any part of our program, go to townhallreview.com for the full episode. While you're there, take a moment to sign up for our podcast. It really is the best of the best in conservative talk radio. Thanks to Iran and more recently the reckless defiance of North Korea, talk of nuclear weapons continues to fill the news. In a press conference surrounding the visit of Canadian Prime Minister Trudeau for NAFTA talks, President Trump responded to questions, including one on our nuclear arsenal.
I want to have absolutely perfectly maintained, which we are in the process of doing, nuclear force. But when they said I want 10 times what we have right now, it's totally unnecessary, believe me, because I know what we have right now.
You want no increase whatsoever? You're happy with
it? We won't need an increase, but I want modernization and I want total rehabilitation. It's got to be in tip-top shape.
I spoke to Wisconsin Congressman Ann Marie Mike Gallagher, a national security expert. What do you make of the story that the president went into the tank and saw the charts and wants a lot more nukes and he wants modernization?
I am all for the president being all in on modernization, which is desperately needed in our nuclear force. Since 1945, our nuclear deterrent has been the U.S. strategic advantage over our adversaries. The argument that we haven't used them so they're irrelevant is completely dumb, for lack of a better word. Because nuclear weapons are defense dominant. Their primary utility is that they confer a defensive advantage upon the country that possesses them, which makes us unconquerable in the traditional territorial sense. And the best use of nuclear weapons is often non-use. Another way of saying that is that nuclear weapons are primarily a means of strategic communication, and in this sense, they are continually in use.
we as the deterring power, we combine our technology and our will in such a way as to convince other countries that an attack will trigger a devastating response. So I don't understand that. And then on the merits, on the numbers, the president has a point. At the end of the Cold War in 91, the U.S. deployed more than 10,000 warheads on delivery vehicles. That number has declined to less than 1,500 deployed warheads today and is slated to be 1,550 deployed warheads in 2018 after the New START Treaty completes implementation. The New START Treaty has reduced the number of warheads we have deployed. And as for the different ways we deliver these, as you know, Hugh, and as you've been asking every presidential candidate and everyone, the triad needs to be preserved and extend that, in particular, the most survivable leg of the triad, which are our strategic ballistic missiles.
Yesterday, Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, whom you have served, said that members of President Trump's National Security Council should understand it is treasonous to leak to the media about national security deliberations. He said that.
I agree with H.R. completely, and I can't understand the motive of these leakers other than self-aggrandizement. I mean, you're the lawyer, Hugh. Pick your statute that you want to rely upon for why this is criminal and treasonous. You have the Espionage Act of 1917, codified in 18 U.S. Code 793. Later amendments added 18 U.S.C. 798, criminalizing the disclosure of various kinds of classified information. You pick it. I mean, HR, I think, hit the nail on the head. This is treasonous. It needs to stop because it only hurts our country at a time of profound international crisis. It seems like there is some dissension between the president and his secretary of state, and I don't know if that's sustainable over the long term. And indeed, if the president has lost confidence in the secretary of state, I don't think continuing that arrangement is workable. So maybe that's the big takeaway. I don't know what to make of it. And I'll also concede that it's less about the number of nukes and more about the triad, as I mentioned before. I believe he is talking about modernization of our delivery systems. We know we need to modernize our warheads. We know that our bombers, which are in some ways the most visible leg of our nuclear deterrence, we need a new long-range strategic bomber. Some of these weapon systems, like our B-52s, are so old they could collect Social Security. That's something you've been talking about for a while. That's something anyone who's taken a hard look at our strategic force would conclude. And at least I hope that's what the president is committed to reversing. But ultimately, that's going to require us to spend a lot more money on defense, which we're not doing right now.
The horror of the Las Vegas shootings has quite possibly numbed our nation's sensibilities. Aside from the usual gun rights chatter, it's eerily quiet now. But the really ugly cleanup continues, and that's part of the investigation. My colleague Mike Gallagher spoke to corporate security specialist Paul Violas about this disturbing timeline news.
Now we're being told 6 minutes before the mass shooting began. Here's the sheriff last night.
As I have conveyed to you from the very beginning, in your zest for information, and my zest to ensure the public safety and the calming of their minds, is some things are going to change. Now, they are minute changes. Okay, there's not this all-encompassing answer associated with the information that we presented before. In other words, it's not completely inaccurate. But what we have learned is Mr. Campos was encountered by the suspect prior to his shooting to the outside world.
Wow, this is very, very troubling. And again, more questions than answers raised by the latest bit of information. Paul Violas, he's the CEO of Violas Group International, and he joins us on our guest line today. Hi, thanks very much, Mr. Violas, for joining us here on the Mike Gallagher Show. How are you?
My pleasure, Michael. Thank you. My pleasure.
You bet. All right. So the timeline has changed dramatically. Is this as big a deal to you as it is to the rest of us?
Not really, but let me explain that.
Okay.
All the listeners kind of get the kind of process and the kind of mosaic of everything that led up to this. When you think about the planning that went involved, that the Paddock had put into place, not just the due diligence, but the planning for that day, it's not surprising that there were odd noises. Could have been drilling, could have been a variety of things, but odd noises coming from his room. When you think about the equipment that he was setting up, not just from the tripods, but from the weapons, the stock, etc., it's not uncommon to think that there would be a noise complaint.
Then he kills himself, and then the police gain entry to the suite. None of that is surprising or problematic to you, Paul?
Well, that part is problematic, and that really speaks to the hotel security at that point, because, you know, the moment that you're going to have somebody or you're dispatching a security officer to a room for a suspicious complaint,
right,
there should be ongoing communication with that individual. And if there's not, I can tell you right now, that's where the hotel, that's where the casino staff security dropped the ball, by not checking in back with that security officer to say, what's your status?
I've seen some reports he fired 200 bullets through the door. I've just gotten shot. The guy is somebody's in 3201 or whatever the room number is. Help, and nobody gains entry.
Now, remember, this is public record. So the moment that they were notified, that's public record, and that's going to fall under a 911 call.
Right, exactly.
So that's easy enough to find out. What I was told was that he was communicating after he had been struck with hotel security. We learned a significant amount from Columbine. There's no doubt about that. And hence the training that police departments undergo right now, the scenario training they undergo right now, is in really on the heels of the lessons we learned there.
Sure.
But the key piece of evidence here is going to be, in answer to your question, when the police were notified. Now, hypothetically, the police are notified after Paddock starts shooting. You've got mass chaos right now. The key part about when the police would know where it was coming from, obviously, because you've got muzzle flashes coming from the 32nd floor from a building 400 or 500 yards away,
right,
that's going to give you the indication where it's coming from. Their response time is going to be predicated upon when they were notified.
Coming up.
What's wrong with the Girl Scouts? Are they going to allow boys into the Girl Scouts? And why not? Why? And they have to change the name or it's false advertising, isn't it?
Dennis Prager, when the Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. It's been nearly 20 years since the famous Boy Scout of America versus Dale decision came down. The Boy Scouts won that case, which allowed them to retain their convictions on membership and leadership in the face of the unfolding sexual revolution. They've been struggling with their own sense of identity ever since. On Wednesday, the Boy Scouts directors announced that girls would be allowed to join. Here's my Salem colleague, Dennis Prager.
I told you everything the left touches, it destroys. The latest is the Boy Scouts. Boy Scouts announced they will accept girls. Yep. The board of directors of the Boy Scouts of America voted unanimously on Wednesday, that's today, right, to allow girls into the century-old organization. What's wrong with the Girl Scouts? Are they going to allow boys into the Girl Scouts? And why not? Why? And they have to change the name or it's false advertising, isn't it? If you call something the Boy Scouts, but girls are in it, then it's really, I think that they should be sued for mislabeling. Well, another victory for the left, another wonderful institution that it has destroyed. I think that we need to form, I don't know how it would work, though. Rather than do this, the board should have disbanded and then create a new organization and be what the Boy Scouts have been for all of their history, this magnificent organization. The last thing they need in the Boy Scouts is girls. Boys don't have males to relate to, by and large. They go to school, the teacher is a female, their principal is a female. Their clergyman, if they go to church, is 50-50 chance, depending on what denomination. The last thing that they really need to grow up to be strong, good men, and if you're not strong, you're not good, is a more female presence in their life. That's the last thing they need. Aside from all the other issues. The group said that beginning in 2018, girls will be allowed into its Cub Scout program, which had been limited to boys in the first through fifth grades, or between the ages of 7 and 10. A separate program for older girls will be announced next year and is expected to be available in 2019. The decision comes nearly 2 months after the organization was harshly criticized by the president of Girl Scouts of the USA for what she said was a, quote, covert campaign to recruit girls. I formally request that your organization stay focused on serving the 90% of American boys not currently participating in Boy Scouts, Kathy Hopin Kahanan, president of the Girl Scouts, wrote to her counterpart. She's right. That's what they should stay focused on, serving the 90% of American boys not currently participating in Boy Scouts. Earlier this year, the Boy Scouts announced a change in its membership requirements, paving the way for transgender boys to join the group. So there will be, see, transgender boy would be a boy with a female body. What the left has done is they have made it bad for transsexuals, because transsexual is not the same as transgender, and that's the term that should be used. Transsexual is not an issue where people literally change their sex, their physical sex. It's when you have the physical body of sex A and you say, accept me as sex B, that people have an issue. And it's not a matter of hate or phobia. It's a pretty logical, understandable issue. The Boy Scouts were Boy Scouts. Girl Scouts were Girl Scouts. And it was a good thing. It was a healthy thing. And now, under the relentless pressure of those with inner turmoil, that was a big deal. People who have inner peace want outer peace. People who have inner turmoil want outer turmoil. The left, I believe the great majority of leftists, not liberals, but the great majority of leftists have inner turmoil. And they are not at peace when the world is at peace, when the world around them is. There's got to stir the pot constantly. That's why the word change is almost erotically charged for them. It's so exciting. Change is to the turmoil personality, to the left-wing personality, what gambling is to the gambling addict. So what's going to happen here? So the left is destroying the Boy Scouts, and then what's going to happen? See, there's no left-wing Boy Scouts. I make this point all the time. They destroy, but they don't build. The university is being destroyed, but is anything being put in its place? No. And on a number of levels, why is it that girls want to leave the Girl Scouts and join the Boy Scouts? Because the Girl Scouts have largely become a feminist organization. And so a lot of the things that they would want for the Girl Scouts apparently don't exist there, and they want to join the Boy Scouts. But then if you join the Boy Scouts, then you obviously don't have the Boy Scouts.
Coming up.
We human beings are different than other creatures. We have perishable bodies, but we have immortal souls. The relation between the body and the soul is you have something for which you are responsible. It's part of you, just like your soul. And so you want to take care of it.
Dr. Larry Arnn of Hillsdale on the Second Amendment. The Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The stark reality of the Las Vegas massacre had hardly registered before the left hit the nation in the face on gun rights. The usual voices, from former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton to late-night show hosts and college sociology professors, heap blame on those who protect our Second Amendment rights. I turn to a longtime friend, Dr. Larry Arnn, the president of Hillsdale College, to talk about the origin of a citizen's right to bear arms. So many people who wish to do injury to the Second Amendment treat it like the invisible man. They treat it like it's not part of the Constitution. And Brett Stevens quite rightly points out, it's there. If you wish to undo it, the framers provided for a means by which to do so.
Well, we talk like this because we have forgotten the purpose of the Constitution of the United States. And the Second Amendment, you have to remember, first of all, the first 10 amendments were not included. Right, they were written right after, and they were part of the compromise to get the Constitution ratified. And in everyone's mind at the time, they were to make the purposes and the functioning of the Constitution more sure and explicit. They were not to change it. And then there are two ways in which you can make the government rely on us. One is the people who are actually in the government should be accountable to us. We can throw them out. And the second one is, huge things are left to us. Indeed, most things are left to us. And one of those things that's left to us is extensively our personal defense. And so they were not thinking, far be it from the thought, that they were going to disarm the American people because now we're going to have a strong government and it's going to be orderly and the government will take care of all that. So they actually pride themselves when they talk of Second Amendment of guns. Thomas Jefferson writes, for example, that in Europe, he'd been ambassador to Paris, he said, to go from town to town, you have to stop in a tavern and find other people who are making the trip and join up with them because you have to go in force. Whereas in America, you never see a highwayman. And the reason you never do it is you do is because somebody will shoot him. And so that thing, see, that, and then, of course, that's connected to the way we defended ourselves extensively in the Revolution. Americans were people good with guns, and they formed an army, and they got pretty good pretty fast. Had to learn to drill, but it didn't have to learn to shoot. So there's a positive statement about the nature of the society in the Second Amendment, and the loss of it would be a constitutional change as grievous as any.
Now, let me read to you, Peggy Noonan, but why do so many Americans have guns? I don't mean those who like to hunt and shoot or live far out and need protection. I don't mean those who have been handed down the guns of their grandfathers or fathers. Why do a significant number of Americans have so many guns? Wouldn't it help if we thought about that, writes Peggy. I think a lot of Americans have guns because they're fearful, and for good reason. They fear a coming chaos and know that when it happens, it will be coming to a nation that no longer coheres. They think it's all collapsing, our society, our culture, the baseline competence of our leadership class. They see the cultural infrastructure giving way, illegitimacy, abused children, neglect, racial tensions, kids on opioids, staring at screens. And unlike their cultural superiors, they understand the implications. Nuts with newts, terrorists bent on a mission. The grid will go down. One of our foes will hit us suddenly and hard. In the end, it could be hand-to-hand, door-to-door. I said some of this 6 years ago to a famously liberal journalist who blinked in surprise. If that's true, he said, they won't have a chance. But they are Americans, I said. They won't go down without a fight. Americans have so many guns because drug gangs roam the streets and because they have less trust in their neighbors, because they've read Cormac McCarthy's The Road, because all of their personal and financial information got hacked in the latest breach, because our country's real overlords are in Silicon Valley and appear to be moral Martians who operate on some weird new postmodern ethical wavelength, and they'll be the ones programming the robots that'll soon take all the jobs. Maybe those robots will all look like Mark Zuckerberg, like the eyeless busts of Roman emperors. Our leaders don't even think about this technological revolution. They're too busy with transgendered rights. Americans have so many guns because they know the water their children swim in hasn't gotten cleaner since Columbine, but more polluted and lethal.
It isn't just fear, right? First of all, it's always dangerous. We human beings are different than other creatures. We have perishable bodies, but we have immortal souls. And so we understand danger in a different way than animals do, and we can think abstractly about it the way we can think every other thing. But another thing is, the relation between the body and the soul is, you have something for which you are responsible. It's part of you, just like your soul. And so you want to take care of it. You are called by nature to take care of it, to grow it, to feed it, right? And a weapon is a tool. And that's so we like all of our tools, right? Guns are special because they're so immediately lethal, but knives and shovels and everything we need to maneuver our way through nature. And that, you know, in economic theory, all of those things are called capital, and they multiply labor and make it stronger. And so there is no mystery whatsoever here. It's just that here, you may wonder, why did the gun culture take place here? First of all, I don't think we have a gun culture in America. We just have a lot of guns. But why do we have a lot of guns? Well, just remember, all of those rights in the first 10 amendments, this is the place where they were first established, right? So you can compare us to England and France. But those guys were backward children trying to learn from us back then. And so we got a head start. I actually think that this debate in politics has been amazingly sober after this incident. This incident is course, like many of them, is really awful. And one of the bad things about it is it's hard to figure out in two senses, who is this guy and what's he up to? The most strongest thing I know about him is a video poker player, and one reads that that's like crack for gamblers. But who knows about that, right? And the second thing is it's pretty clever. You know what he did? Hard to deal with.
Very.
And so the president's first reaction, you know, this reckless, crazy guy, what did he first say? He said, you know, we have to look at that, but not right now. Right now we have to grieve. And that's him repeating the words of the founders that you don't legislate in the middle of a crisis.
Coming up.
And all the little towns that they're taking away, Columbus Day, it's our one day. And thank God for President Trump for saying Happy Columbus Day.
Stay tuned for the final segment of the Town Hall Review. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Joe Piscopo became famous on Saturday Night Live during the 80s. But Joe still commands an audience. Now it's a Salem audience, mornings in New York City, as host of AM 970, The Answer. Joe has recently invested time and energy in saving Columbus Day, along with a number of our at-risk statues. He joined Mike Gallagher to explain.
Can we start with the insanity of wondering why, in October of 2017, a guy from the 1400s is suddenly evil personified? What has changed to make Columbus Day the subject of the wrath of the far left? Why? Why now?
So we have one iconic symbol in this explorer, in Christopher Columbus, who, by today's standards, it would be like going to the moon, what he did. It was incredible what he did. And if you're talking about assaulting indigenous people, look at the United States government. They did that before anybody. So I can't figure out what the end game is. I don't have an explanation on what the end game is and why they're even going after. Is it it could be Christian bashing, Mike. It could be indeed that. Let's take down Christian bashing. It could be an easy target because they think the Italian Americans are just going to sit down. And I will tell you right now, my dear friend, we are not going to sit down.
Good.
But I don't know what the end game is. I think somehow it seems like it's a concerted, paid effort by some anti-American force that's just trying to take out the sovereignty of the United States of America, man.
It's fascinating to look at the history of protests involving Christopher Columbus. The fact of the matter is these leftists and Antifa types who are now directing their ire towards Christopher Columbus statues are in fact joining the Ku Klux Klan, because historically the Ku Klux Klan objected to Columbus Day. The Ku Klux Klan objected to honoring Christopher Columbus because it was perceived as very strong Catholic roots, Klan anti-Catholic.
That's right.
I mean, and so I wonder what some of these dingbats who I see interviewed standing around with stupid sandwich boards objecting to the, you know, I mean, the morons that are on TV. He's a monster. He's terrible. We got to take this down. You realize you're on the side of the Ku Klux Klan lady? I mean, oh, now let's embrace the anti-Columbus Day cause. And Joe, cities all over America, let's start with Los Angeles, changing the doggone name from Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day. This will be the last year we're going to be able to celebrate Columbus Day.
Not in New York City, baby. I'll tell you we are not going to, but you're absolutely right. They will try to take it away. There's a concern. And in New York, it was a celebration. It was rainy. People came out. We were happy. And we were celebrating ethnicity everywhere, the mosaic of the United States of America. It's the foundation of the United States, Mike. But I felt like I'm in New York. I'm in another universe. When you go out, and you're right, in Los Angeles, in all the little towns that they're taking away, Columbus Day, it's our one day. And thank God for President Trump for saying Happy Columbus Day.
That's it for our program today. Catch up on past episodes at our website, townhallreview.com. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. You can also catch us on Google Play and SoundCloud. For executive producer Russell Schubin and producers Charlie Richards, David Posian, Chanda Chisala, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne Patterson, I'm Hugh Hewitt, inviting you to join us next week for another edition of Town Hall Review, the week in review program from a perspective you can trust.